Chapter 41. The sky was dodger blue as Liam left the hotel lobby. A breeze rolled down from the hills and rustled the trees in the parks, carrying the scent of spring wildflowers. Liam stopped for a brief moment in a park. With his hands in his pockets, he breathed deeply of the sweet air and took in the scene. A group of young boys were kicking a soccer ball. Two mothers were taking an afternoon walk, pushing their babies in strollers. It could have been Central Park, or even Lincoln Park. But the ancient towers and domes rising above the trees gave a singular majesty to the landscape. He was in Jerusalem. It was a short walk to the Jaffa Gate, and thence to the Muslim Quarter and the Via Dolorosa. The narrow stone passageways of the old city, with their tiny market stalls, diverse sounds and fragrances, were jammed with tourists. He stopped often to check for an address, and when he did, a smiling shopkeeper offering surely the most exquisite purchase in all of Israel would quickly approach him and tug at his sleeve. Finally, Liam spotted Abu Hamad's shop, shoehorned between a jewelry store and rug shop. No name or number was over the door or stenciled on the milky window. Nothing that would identify the business that was conducted inside, except for a small cardboard sign sitting on the inside window ledge that said, "Antiquities." The door was unlocked and Liam pushed it open. "Hello?" he said as he slowly entered the shop. A tall brass urn sat like a center pole amid assorted pottery bowls, masks, maps, scrolls, copper bowls, hand-forged weapons and books. Stacks of books. Shelves of books. Piles of books. The musty smell of old books permeated the store.
"This is like a medieval garage sale," Liam muttered.
It was hard to find a path through the room. Liam stopped to admire a large, flat, egg-shaped stone. He could barely make out the chiseled carvings that the ages had weathered away.
"It is part of a rolling stone, no doubt used to seal the entrance to a burial cave," said a deep voice in a thick Arabic accent.
Liam caught sight of the man's reflection in a framed mirror as he materialized from the clutter and shuffled forward. Abu Hamad was tall, maybe 6'2", but the years had bowed his back. He wore a gray tunic that hung down to his thighs. The loose three-quarter sleeves rustled when he moved his arms. A knitted takia covered the dome of his unruly white hair. Decades of Middle Eastern sun had darkened his skin and carved deep folds in his forehead and the borders of his eyes. A rough goatee framed his wide mouth. By contrast, Liam, in his jeans and Ulster rugby shirt, was merely one of a million tourists who packed the stone passageways of the old city.
"Maybe it sealed the cave Jesus was in before he ascended. No?"
Abu Hamad laughed heartily. Then he flipped his hand.
"Probably a piece of a burial stone from the 3rd century. The inscription is interesting. Rise with the morning dove, O learned one. How do I help you, sir?"
"I come for conversation."
Abu Hamad squinted, as though that would help him more clearly see what Liam was all about.
"I like the conversation where you want to buy something that I have, and I want to sell it to you."
"Perhaps a small item before I go, but I would like to talk to you about Dr. Arif al-Zahani."
"Ho, ho! Now it comes to me."
Abu Hamad smiled broadly.
"You are here about the girl, Sophie.
You know about her?"
He shrugged his big shoulders.
"Hebron is a close community."
"But you are in Jerusalem."
"Business is better."
"I've been told that you know the doctor." Abu Hamad pursed his lips and gave a nod.
"Know him? Knew his father. Even knew his grandfather."
"I've been hired to see what can be done to return Sophie to her home."
Abu Hamad turned and walked to the back of his store.
"Will you have a cup of tea?"
Liam followed, stopping to examine a copper plate.
"It's junk," Abu Hamad called out over his shoulder. 18th century Persian.
He dragged a wooden chair into a small sitting area.
a worn, overstuffed chair, covered in crackled maroon leather, sat next to an antique sideboard. He set out a pot of hot water, two cups, and infusers on a table, poured a cup for himself, then sat down in his stuffed chair.
"I do not think Arif intends to return the girl. He is fond of her."
"So is her father." Liam measured a small amount of tea into the infuser and poured himself a cup. "I've heard that maybe the doctor seeks to make a deal."
"I confess, sir, that you have heard more than I. From whom did you hear such things?"
Liam shrugged. Abu Hamad shook his head.
"Al-Zahani is a rigid man. Unforgiving. Bitter. He makes no compromises. It is in his bloodlines. He is just like his father and his grandfather. It is not like him to make a deal."
Abu Hamad stood, shuffled to the back wall, and beckoned Liam with his index finger. He pointed to a black-and-white photograph in a black frame. Three men in white keffiyehs stood with rifles in their hands. Liam studied the picture. Abu Hamad tapped the figure on the right.
"That is Hamid al-Zahani."
Liam nodded. "Arif's father. And the others?" Abu Hamad tapped his finger on the figure to the left, turned, and went back to his chair. "That's you? With the rifle?" Abu Hamad picked up his tea. Age palsied his hand a bit.
"In 1966.
Liam returned to his seat and took a sip.
"I was born in Haifa."
Abu Hamad leaned back in his stuffed chair.
"My family lived at the foot of the Carmel Mountains in the home of my ancestors. Arif's grandfather, Ibrahim, moved two doors away after Hamid al-Zahani was born. Arif was born there. He grew up swimming in the sea, playing on the streets of Haifa. Ibrahim was counsel to the Mufti and spent most of his time in Jerusalem. I remember him bragging to us that von Ribbentrop had invited the Mufti to Berlin to sit with the Führer, and that he, Ibrahim, was going along as well. During the Second World War, he and the Mufti stayed in Germany. But Ibrahim would come back every now and then. He taught his son and his grandson to hate the British, the Americans, the Jews."
"But not you?" Abu Hamad shook his head.
"Ibrahim did not teach me. Besides, I was busy with other pursuits."
He pointed at a small oval picture frame. The silver was tarnished a bit, but one could see it had been cared for over the years. In the frame was a black and white photo of a young woman.
"Very lovely.
She looks kind."
"She was that."
"Did your family stay in Haifa?" Liam asked, though he knew the answer. The old man raised his eyebrows.
"We left Haifa in 1948, as ordered by the Arab command. We were told that the Syrian army would soon overrun the city and expel all the Jews. Then we could come back. It was pure fantasy. But my family was non-violent, and we listened to others in the community. We left when they did."
"But there is a picture of you with a rifle."
"Well, yes, when I was young. The PLO was passing out Soviet rifles, so I took one."
Abu Hamad shrugged.
"I was not much of a soldier. I gave it back."
He chuckled.
"I confess that I am a man of peace. Perhaps just a coward, as Arif has called me."
"He called you a coward?"
"Many times. In May 1967, just before the war, his father was recruiting for the Jordanian army. Hamid was commanding a division based in Hebron. They came to my house, Arif and Ibrahim, with enlistment papers. There would be great glory, they said. We would drive the Jews to the sea and rid Palestine of Jews forever. I declined. I stayed home with my Saja. I did not fight in 67. Arif tried to shame me into joining, but I refused."
"And Arif, did he join his father?"
Abu Hamad chuckled and shook his head. "He did not. He went to medical school. But Hamid, like his father, was a born fighter. It was as if he started battling the moment he came out of the womb. He was always in the middle of some skirmish, with guns and grenades. He met his maker in the Kidron Valley during the siege of Jerusalem in 1967. Arif blames many for his father's death. The weak Jordanians, the aggressive Israelis, and me.
You?
People like me. I refused to fight. I did not stand on the hill and fire weapons alongside Hamid. To Arif, I will always be a coward.
And his father's death? That would account for Arif's vendetta? The old man scratched the side of his cheek.
It doesn't take much to impassion a displaced Arab, one who thinks his land has been taken from him. Double so for Arif, who lost his father and his grandfather to Israeli gunfire. He has a vendetta, to use your word, against many. The British, the State of Israel, the UN, the US, peaceful Arabs, and me.
Because you didn't fight.
Partly. Also because I'm a shopkeeper. I get my money in Israel. I am like a collaborator, a traitor to the cause. Maybe I should live in a refugee camp in Jordan. Pretend that Israel does not exist. Take the meager welfare handouts from the UN. Wait for the great uprising. According to Arif, that would be honorable. Doing business with the Israelis is dishonorable. We have been on opposite sides of the philosophical fence for many, many years.
But Arif does not live in a camp.
Abu Hamad chuckled. The gentleman doctor. He lives in his father's fortified castle.
He stood and stretched.
Ah, I am tired. I have talked too long.
Liam stood as well. I thank you very much for sharing that information with me. I would like to know a little more about Sophie Summers, whether there are arrangements.
I have heard no talk of plans to return the girl, or, as you say, to make a deal. There are some in Hebron who would know. For you and for her father, I will inquire. Come back. Next time, buy something.
Upon returning to the King David, Liam found a note waiting for him.
We are going to Hebron tomorrow. Be ready at noon. Kayla.
Liam reached for his cell phone and dialed Catherine.
Hi, Cat, it's me.
Hi, me. How's it going?
Okay, I guess.
I met a shopkeeper today who has contacts in Hebron, and I'm hoping he'll flush out a little information for us. We're going there tomorrow. How was court today?
Surprising. Kelson showed up. It was just a routine status call, just the attorneys positioning themselves for an upcoming round of depositions. It was not the kind of thing that clients ever attend. But there was Victor Kelson, brash as ever, barking at the courtroom trying to get his case accelerated for trial. Judge Sherwin almost threw him in jail.
Where does the lawsuit stand? Is there a trial date?
Preliminarily, January 17th.
Of course, that'll be kicked back. It's far too early in the game.
There are several cross-complaints and motions pending. At this stage, there's no evidence proving who is at fault or how the wire instructions were altered. Key witnesses are dead or missing, and no one knows where the money is. It's actually quite fascinating.
Isn't there a presumption that Jenkins and Fairchild was responsible?
A presumption, but rebuttable. J&F never had possession of the money. It was under the control of the title company.
But didn't J&F direct the title company to send the money to a false account?
The wire instructions bore three signatures, Summers, Harrington, and Ellis. At this point, we don't even know if the signatures are valid.
Oh, come on, Cat. Summers had the motive and the means. He took off right after the money was wired.
So did Harrington.
So did Ellis.
$80 million is a lot of motive. Anyway, those are the competing arguments. This case is just beginning.
Cat, I miss you, and I love you.
I know. Me too.
Chapter 42.
Child, you're weeping.
Al-Zahani stood next to Sophie's bed. She lay on her side, facing away from him, holding tightly to her bear.
Tell me what troubles you so.
Sophie shook her head.
What the children mean to you? I will send Bashir to punch them all right in the nose.
Sophie smiled, shook her head again, and sniffled.
Jamila can't play with me anymore. She was my only friend.
Why not? I thought you were good friends.
We are, but her father won't let us play anymore. She told me at school.
Did she say why?
Sophie sadly shook her head. Al-Zahani ran his hand smoothly over her hair.
I will speak to him. I'm sure it's just a misunderstanding. It will get straightened out. Don't be sad.
Despite his reassurance, she sobbed.
I miss my mommy and my daddy. I miss my friends. I want to go home. I don't belong here.
Oh, Sophie, so many times I tell you there is no one at your American home. It is empty. I proved it to you. You made the telephone calls. This is now your home. You do belong here. Of all people, I know it is sad to lose your home. Do you know when I was just a boy, about the same age as you, I lost my home?
Sophie looked up.
You did?
My family's home in Haifa was taken from us by the Israelis. We were forced to run off to Jordan. But now I have a new home, and you have a new home. We are here for you now, because your parents have left you. Your dada and I will make sure you are well-loved always, and grow up to be a beautiful, strong woman.
Sophie rolled over to face Al-Zahani. Her eyes were red.
My mommy didn't leave me. She went to heaven.
It is hard for me to speak of her with you. It makes me sad, just like you. Maybe someday.
Why did she have to die?
Al-Zahani hesitated.
It is because she had turned from her faith.
Was Allah angry with her?
I do not know what is in the mind of Allah. But perhaps.
He reached down and smoothed the covers.
It is time for sleep.
Could you read me a story?
I'm sorry, but I don't have any children's books, and I don't know many children's stories. I can tell you stories about the Prophet Muhammad. He too lost his father and his mother.
Al-Zahani pulled back her covers and tucked her in.
What is your favorite book?
If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. That's my favorite.
I will find it and buy it for you.
It's very good and funny.
I will send Bashir first thing in the morning. And we will find out what happens when you give a mouse a cookie, he said, which elicited a few giggles. Now tonight, you go to sleep.
Al-Zahani kissed her on the forehead, turned out the lights, and left the room. In the sitting room, Lubana was smiling.
Are you building your relationship, Arif?
Al-Zahani looked serious.
What is the situation with Jamila? Sophie is upset. This was her only friend. We cannot allow a setback.
Lubana lowered her head.
Hassan will no longer let Jamila associate with Sophie. He says that Sophie talks constantly of her life in America and the things that she does. She tells Jamila how wonderful it is. She praises America. Hassan says he cannot allow such ideas to be put into Jamila's head. He has ordered Basima to keep their daughter away from Sophie. Basima is sorry, but there is nothing she can do.
Al-Zahani curled his lip.
Well, there is something I can do. I will talk with Hassan. He does not know Sophie. If he took the time to know her, he would see that she is worthy of his respect. She's not like other Americans. I will change his mind. You will see Jamila back here very soon. That I promise you. Do not worry.
Lubana wrapped her arms around Al-Zahani.
I like it when you're strong for our Sophie.
She is so much like Alina.
He kissed Lubana on the forehead.
She has a will, that one. A curiosity. I see much in her future. In a few weeks, though, I may need you to take her to Oman until my business is finished.
Why must we leave?
Because it is my wish. For your safety and hers.
I thought the years of such business were over.
No more questions, please. I have to leave.
Where are you going tonight, Arif? Again, every night. Why do you go out so often?
I have many responsibilities. Why do you interrogate me?
When will you be home?
Do not wait up.
Chapter 43. On her way to Hebron, barely 30 minutes south of the old city, Kayla took a cutoff through the Rachel's Crossing checkpoint and drove the agency car into the crowded city of Bethlehem, where she made her way to the central area and the Church of the Nativity. The square is now a pedestrian mall, so I'll have to park a few blocks away. She maneuvered her way past several parked tour buses.
Why are we stopping here? Liam asked.
I need to meet with someone, just for a minute. And I thought you might like to see Bethlehem. It's a Palestinian town, although very touristy. It's friendly. Very different from Hebron. Westerners are commonplace here.
Kayla pulled into a parking space, locked the car, and fed the meter.
Called Bethlehem, House of Bread, Bethlehem has always been a small, poor town, she said as they walked. When Jesus was born, there were maybe 400 residents. Compared to the larger West Bank cities, Bethlehem is still very small, 22,000 today. The economy is almost entirely tourist-driven. It was one of the areas handed over to the PA in 1995, after the Oslo Peace Accords.
Zone A?
Kayla nodded.
Correct, Zone A.
Self-governed by the PA.
They walked to a small diner on a side street. Standing on the sidewalk, Kayla pointed to a white tower.
That's the Mosque of Omar, which sits at one end of Manger Square. Before modern times, Muslims and Christians would share the responsibility of bringing oil to light the lamps of the square. She peered in the window of the restaurant.
If you wouldn't mind right now, there's someone I need to see. Could you wait just a bit? Better yet, why don't you go on in and order some falafel? It's great here.
I'll just hang out here.
Kayla entered the restaurant, and a few minutes later emerged with a small man with a neatly trimmed black beard. He nodded to Liam.
Liam, this is Kadeen, a friend of mine. I need a few minutes with Kadeen, if that's okay.
Kayla and Kadeen walked to the corner, crossed the street, and disappeared into a small gray building. Liam leaned on a parking meter and took in the scene. Bethlehem might be small, but the square was crowded. People watching was enjoyable. Many were obviously tourists in Western attire. Others were covered in traditional Arab dress. A boy in shorts and woven sandals tugged at Liam's sleeve and offered to sell him a plastic manger scene.
Baby Jesus, only $20, the boy said with a wide smile.
$20?
Okay, $5.
Liam dug into his pocket and pulled out a 10.
I take that too, the boy said,
and Liam made the purchase. 15 minutes later, Kayla returned alone.
Sorry for the delay.
She pointed at the souvenir.
I see you've already improved Bethlehem's balance sheet.
Cute kid. I couldn't resist. The restaurant was small, 15 tables tightly organized. Liam and Kayla sat at a table for two beside a brick wall. A busy waiter in a white apron put down paper placemats with graphics of the square, a basket of hot pitas, and a bowl of hummus. He set out cardboard menus and olive oil. Although Liam could not understand any of the multiple conversations, the milieu was a tasty slice of West Bank.
Am I supposed to know why you met with Kadeen?
Kayla shook her head.
Just a friend I needed to talk to.
Liam looked around the restaurant and smiled.
What do you find humorous?
A thought occurred to me, Liam said. That this is Portillo's of the West Bank, minus the Italian beef.
I'd hoped you'd make that observation.
Look around. What do you see?
He shrugged.
Just ordinary folks having lunch at a local diner?
What am I supposed to see?
Just what you said. Ordinary folks. People who have jobs and businesses and go home to their kids at night. These people aren't terrorists. They're not dangerous. They just want to live their lives in peace. The man I met with, Kadeen, is a sweet man with a beautiful family. He's a man that works for peace and longs for peace in this troubled land.
People like Cardin deserve peace just the same as the ordinary folks on the other side of the separation wall. He deserves self-determination, autonomy, peaceful relations. He deserves a Palestinian state. But Al-Zahani, the sons of Canaan, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and all the other extremists will do anything they can to prevent that from occurring. Why do you say that? Don't they also espouse the Palestinian cause? No. Peaceful solution leading to two states is the Palestinian cause. Israel is already a state. Palestine wants to be one. And it won't get there if terrorists run their government. Guaranteed secured borders, negotiated between responsible parties, is the only way the conflict can be resolved. It will never be resolved by terror. And you think the sons of Canaan are planning an attack to thwart peace talks? I'm not sure the present talks are significant to them. But it's clear the Islamist extremists don't want any talks to result in a two-state solution if one of the states is Israel. They are anti-solution. They foster hate. And to that end, they've been enormously successful. They've stoked the fires of racism on both sides of the fence. From an early age, the young Palestinians are carefully taught to believe Israeli Jews are their natural enemies. On the Israeli side, bombs, rockets, tunnels, kidnapping, and fiery rhetoric have demonized the Palestinians. Israelis are against a two-state solution because they fear extremists will infiltrate and control a Palestinian state. During the 50-day war with Gaza, 4,500 rockets were launched and aimed at Israeli cities. Air raid sirens sounded many times each day. People lived in shelters. Children were traumatized. Israelis who were formerly liberal and sympathetic to the Palestinians became hardened right-wingers. Ben-Gurion International Airport is less than 10 miles from the West Bank. In the last skirmish, the FAA and the EU halted air traffic when a Hamas rocket landed in a field 2 miles away. What if Hamas, Hezbollah, or some other Islamist extremist group took over a fragile West Bank government? They've already threatened Ben-Gurion many times over. What do you think the FAA would do if there were a hostile Palestinian state within easy striking distance of the airport? The sad fact is this. Both sides are victims to the terrorists. As President Peres said, the Arabs are not Israel's enemy. The terrorists are the enemies of both of us. And the consequence is further polarization of the two peoples, which of course serves the terrorists' goals. I understand, Liam said, constructing a large falafel sandwich on fresh-baked pita with lettuce, tomatoes, onions, and tahini. Golda Meir once said, I fear the war with the Arabs will go on for years because of the indifference with which their leaders send their people off to die. She also said, peace will come when the Arabs love their children more than they hate us. Kayla gestured at the people eating their lunch. These everyday folks, they don't want to die. They want quality of life. We have to counter the teaching of intolerance. It'll mean peace for both sides. Kayla, this falafel is calling my name. What do you say we stop talking and eat for a while? Can I tell you something funny? Now that would be a welcome change. Golda also said, let me tell you the one thing I have against Moses. He took us 40 years into the desert in order to bring us to the one place in the Middle East that has no oil. Liam, with his mouth full of food, suppressed a chuckle, took his napkin and wiped his face. By the way, I think this is the best falafel I ever had. There's a restaurant in Jerusalem that serves falafel just as fresh and just as tasty. The falafel tastes the same on both sides of the wall. There's really no difference. Lord almighty, Kayla, I get it. You're beating on a dead horse. She smiled proudly. Resuming their drive to Hebron, just south of Bethlehem, Liam pointed to a hillside town. What's up there? That depends who you ask. Palestinians would say it's an illegal settlement. It's a town west of the Green Line where Israeli citizens live. That one is Nev Daniel, formerly a farm belonging to the Cohen family going back almost 100 years. There are 120 or so Israeli towns that are located in the West Bank, with almost 500,000 Israeli citizens. Many live in large cities that have grown up over the past 45 years, with schools, parks, hospitals, factories, and thriving businesses, many of which employ thousands of Palestinian workers. How do these people end up there? Why were Israeli cities built in the West Bank? Towns expanded naturally. Families grow. Businesses form. Housing in Israel is expensive, especially in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, so families move to areas where they can afford to buy, into new construction, subdivisions built on previously unoccupied and unused land. So now, in the disputed territories, there are 500,000 or more Israelis. The PA calls them settlers or occupiers. They want them all to leave. What would you do with those towns and cities? Why would you have to do anything? Why can't they remain in a newly created state of Palestine? Arabs live in Israel, don't they? They do. But numerous polls have shown that Israelis, even Arab Israelis, don't want to live in the proposed state of Palestine, and the Palestinian leadership doesn't want them there. Mahmoud Abbas said, "In a final resolution, we would not see the presence of a single Israeli civilian or soldier on our land." Palestinians don't want to live in Israel and vice versa. This afternoon we'll arrive in Kiryat Arba, dead center of the West Bank, a town of 7,500 Israelis. Beautiful homes, shops, businesses, intelligent use of the land. Almost 50 years of natural growth. Jews have been in Kiryat Arba for over 3,700 years. It's a settlement as old as the Bible. Are you going to tell those people to pack up and leave? They don't have a right to live there anymore. So, what's the Kayla solution? You're giving me too much credit. I'm not a Nobel Prize-winning statesman, and that's what it will take. But as long as the radical terrorists and jihadists are able to influence the Palestinian populace, a peaceful, shared border is out of the question. We need for the Palestinians to renounce violence as a political tool. Men like Kadeen are working for that, at great risk to himself and his family. I don't doubt for a minute that the world would get behind Palestine if it denounced extremism. Divan Avenue, that's what you need, Liam said matter-of-factly. Divan Avenue? Starting at McCormick Boulevard, driving east on Divan, you'll pass an Orthodox Jewish community, then an Arab community, then a Croatian cultural center. Further east, it's Pakistani, further east, it's Indian, then Korean, all within 3 miles. A melange of food stores, restaurants, clothing shops, bakeries. Just about the most interesting street in Chicago. And all the folks live right in the neighborhood, and most attend neighborhood public schools. That's what you need out here. Divan Avenue. Kayla nodded and smiled. Maybe so. Do you have terrorists on Divan Avenue? Point taken. Kiryat Arba, the town on the hill, was quiet when they arrived, though Liam felt an eerie sense of tension in the air. Kayla parked the car in front of a 3-story building, similar to many of the other structures lining the streets of Kiryat Arba. Cream-colored Jerusalem stone, box-like window openings cut into the facade, many covered with iron gratings. The city looked bright, new and clean, but nervous. No children were playing unguarded on the streets. The agency apartment was efficiently furnished with functional pieces. 3 bedrooms surrounded a sitting area with leather couches and black cube end tables. Wooden stools were tucked under the kitchenette bar. There are 2 wireless connections here, Kayla said, handing Liam a note card. You may use this one. The password is on the card. It's secure. I'll take the back bedroom. Chapter 44.
I contacted the Wilson bro this afternoon.
The cell phone connection was patchy, but the caller's tough street dialect was clear enough.
You saw her? Did you go into her house?
No, sir. I talked to her on the phone. She wouldn't open the door for me.
And? Did she tell you where her brother was?
Nah.
What did you say to her?
Just like you told me. I said I had a package addressed to John Summers. It was an oil painting made from a photograph of Mr. and Mrs. Summers and their kid. I told her that Mrs. Summers had ordered it over 1 year ago from our Chicago office, but she never picked it up and we were trying to find Mr. Summers to deliver it. We were told that she was the sister. Could you give me his address so I could deliver it? It's all prepaid. Very beautiful.
Exactly. What did Wilson say?
She said she hasn't talked to her brother in years. As far as she knew, he lived in Chicago. I told her we went there, but it didn't look like anybody was still living there. And then I talked to the neighbor who gave us her address. So could she give me a forwarding address for her brother so I could send it there? Then she told me she had no idea. Don't bother her no more.
Silence. Then,
she's not telling the truth.
We can make her talk. She's got kids. She'll give up Summers if I start to talk about her kids. Want me to make the call?
Silence. Then,
not yet, Yuri. Maybe later. Right now, I have another idea.
In a shotgun bungalow on Chicago's northwest side, a young man sat in front of a wall of electronic equipment. His tousled hair was omnidirectional, over his ears and badly in need of a scissors. A plaid shirt was buttoned to the neck, and his wide leather belt gathered the waist of his rumpled khakis. Behind him, in designer casual wear, a man stood looking over the young man's shoulder at the computer screen.
Well, Marvin, is it something you can do or not?
The young man nodded.
Should be,
he answered, though everything he said was qualified with a cautionary negative.
Unless he uses a sophisticated scrambler.
He's not sophisticated. He's just a paper pusher. I need to know where this man is when he goes online, when he leaves the message. Can you pinpoint his location?
Marvin tilted back in his chair and shrugged boastfully.
It depends on how you define pinpoint. When he emails you, I can get his IP address. If he uses an internet cafe, some public source, I can probably give you the location.
Marvin smiled smugly.
I have my ways of getting it from the ISP.
Of course, if the man has installed a few security features that I sell, most people don't know about them. He shrugged.
You'd have to hire somebody like me.
Well, let's assume he hasn't hired someone like you, Marvin. How can you get this done? How can you tell us where he is when he posts?
It would be best if I were online at the time. When do you think that'll be?
I can prompt him. Stay by your computer. You'll post later today. I guarantee it.
Summer stared out of the window of his second-story motel room. The kids across the street were kicking a soccer ball. Spaces between the parked cars served as goals. For a moment, just a snippet in time, Jack saw Sophie running toward the ball. All of her teammates, 5-year-old girls in their oversized team T-shirts, were running en masse, converging on the ball, kicking to beat the band. Jack stood on the sidelines with Alina and the other parents, cheering and laughing heartily. The amped bass from the corner bar, booming thunder through the neighborhood, brought Jack back to the present. He checked his watch. In 30 minutes, he was meeting Marcy at the Polynesian room.
I'm standing here reminiscing about the three of us, Alina. And I'm about to go to dinner with Marcy Grant. And you know what? I can't get the vision of her open robe out of my head. Would you scold me for that? Is it appropriate for me to have these thoughts? Answer me, Alina. Would you approve? Is the timing all wrong? For me? For her? Don't answer. I know it is.
He grabbed his laptop and walked around the corner to the internet cafe. One more disappointing check of his email account before dinner. But to his absolute shock, a new message was posted. Happy to say that the deal is almost done. I need your help in signing parental authorization to bring Sophie back into the country. U.S. immigration regulations, that's all that's left. Can you meet with me? If not, can I email the forms to you? Summers could barely contain his enthusiasm. His heart was beating like a hummingbird. He quickly typed, "Wonderful news. Of course you can email forms. Just attach them and I'll scan and send them back right away. When are you going to get her? I need to arrange to have someone meet you and Sophie. Please give me all the details. I can't thank you enough." Summers couldn't wait to tell Marcy. Standing on the sidewalk outside the Polynesian room, he felt like jumping up and down. He checked out every taxi that approached. Finally, she arrived.
"You didn't have to wait on the curb," she said with a smile. "I would have come inside."
Summers hugged her excitedly and swung her around.
"It's happening, Marcy. Sophie's coming home. We didn't need to talk to Taggart after all. My original plan is going to work."
"That's fabulous. I can't believe it. When is she coming?"
"I just got the message on the email account. They didn't give me a date. They just said they needed my parental authorization."
Marcy's smile lost some of its exuberance.
"They didn't ask you to show up personally, did they?"
"They asked me if I can meet them, but..."
"Oh no, Jack. That's what Taggart warned me about. You're the third and final witness."
"It's not like that. They don't know where I am. For all they know, I could still be in Chicago. They gave me the option of signing the parental authorization and scanning it back to them. I don't have to meet with them personally."
"How are they going to deliver Sophie?"
"We haven't discussed the details, but I can have Deborah pick her up anywhere."
"I don't mean to burst your bubble, but I'm worried about this email."
Jack put his arm around her.
"You're a worrywart. It'll be fine. Sophie will be out here in no time. Let's go inside and celebrate."
Jack called the waiter over and ordered a pricey bottle of wine. He couldn't stop smiling. His batteries were fully charged. His enthusiasm was contagious, and Marcy felt elated as well.
"I can't wait to see Sophie,"
Marcy said.
"She's such a special kid. I hope this ordeal hasn't been too rough on her. You know, it'll probably take a while for her to get readjusted."
"I think she'll do all right. She's strong, and she's solid emotionally. Alina was right. She's unusual in that way."
Jack leaned forward and spoke reflectively.
"You want to know something about her that I never realized until after Alina was gone? Sophie has this uncanny sense of empathy. Not just uncanny for a little girl, but for anyone. She can sense your emotion, what you're experiencing. She can share in your joy or know when you're unsure of yourself and give you the benefit of the doubt, and you can draw strength from her. When I was at the end of the road, she was strong for me. We were strong for each other, just like we had promised Alina. How many people can do that? And she's only 6 years old." He swallowed hard. "Alina always said she was remarkable, that she would change the world. I teased her about it, but Alina was right."
Marcy concurred with a nod. Jack tilted his head.
"Do you think I'm just a father blowing smoke?"
"Nope. Not at all. I know her. She's just like her mother."
He smiled, but after a moment sat back and shook his head.
"This whole scenario, the kidnap, the rescue, it never had to happen. I failed her, Marcy. She trusted me, and I let her down. I badly misjudged the Alzahanis, and now Sophie's the one who's suffering, locked up on the other side of the world. What would become of her if she were forced to live under house arrest in Hebron? She deserved better than me. Alina told me to take care of her, and I didn't do it."
"Stop, Jack. Why are you beating yourself up? We're here to celebrate, remember? She's coming home. This is a night for gaiety."
"You're right." He lifted his glass. "Here's to Sophie's return."
They feasted on a 3-pound lobster and banana flambé. When the plates had been cleared, Jack said,
"Is there some place we can go? I want to celebrate. I want to dance."
"You dance?"
"Like Astaire."
"You dance like Fred Astaire."
"No, I was thinking about Myron Astaire, his half-cousin."
Marcy picked up her purse.
"I think they have a club across the street at the Hyatt."
At the end of the long hotel lobby, behind the fountain, to the dismay of Jack and Marcy, a sign on the glass door read, "Closed for remodeling."
"Doesn't that figure?"
Marcy said.
"I finally have someone who will actually take me dancing, and the club is closed."
"Shh.
Listen." The driving sound of a thumping bass came from the other end of the lobby. They followed the music to a large ballroom, where the kiosk announced, "Reception for the Fishman Donovan wedding." Jack looked at the signboard and shrugged.
Okay. Which one do we know, the bride or the groom?
Definitely the bride, Marcy said, and they barged into the party.
The wooden dance floor in the middle of the room was packed, shoulder to shoulder. People laughing, spilling drinks, dancing exuberantly. From time to time, Jack and Marcy would sit one out, catch their breath, have a drink, compliments of Fishman or Donovan, and then jump right back onto the floor. Toward the end of the evening, close to midnight, the band played its final number. Marcy rested her head softly on Jack's chest. He clasped his arms around her waist, and they swayed more than they danced. The music ended, but not the moment, and they continued to sway to the silence. Their eyes met, and Marcy whispered,
"You're wondering if all this is okay, aren't you? The way you feel."
Jack gave a slight nod.
"Is it okay for either of us? Especially at this time?"
"Well, it's okay for me. It's more than okay. You have to decide for yourself if you can handle it. If you can move on with your life."
When the dance floor cleared, they may not have been the only ones locked in an embrace, but they were the only crashers. As they stood there, Jack was tapped on the shoulder.
"You guys are a cute couple," the woman said. "I'm Sue Fishman," she held out her hand. "Pat's sister."
"We're Jack and Marcy," Jack replied, taking her hand. "Mazel tov."
"On behalf of the Protestant Fishmans and the Catholic Donovans, I thank you. Do you guys know anybody at this wedding?"
"Just Sue Fishman, Pat's sister." The young woman giggled.
"There's an after party around the corner at Kiki's. Please come. There's a band."
Marcy looked at Jack. They both nodded.
"Thanks so much. We'll be there."
They walked into the lobby and Marcy stopped.
"Jack, we have to get a card."
"Where are we going to get a card at midnight?"
"Then at least an envelope. We have to give them a wedding gift. They allowed us to celebrate with them. We can probably get an envelope at the front desk."
Jack nodded.
"There's something else I can do at the front desk."
Arm in arm, they walked across the lobby.
"The Rubicon,"
Jack mumbled.
"What?"
"The Rubicon. I was thinking out loud."
"And what's that supposed to mean?"
"Nothing. It's a river in northern Italy."
"On such a wonderful romantic evening, you're thinking of rivers in Italy? Really?"
"No, that's not it."
Jack had a comfortable expression on his face. Julius Caesar, in command of his army, crossed the Rubicon River into the state of Italy on his march toward Rome. It was a capital offense, an act of war. But from then on, everything would change and nothing would be the same. The Rubicon's always been a symbol for the point of no return. Take a step this way and things change. Before tonight, I wouldn't let myself think about anything but Sophie. My personal life, my own future, was out of the question. You asked me if I can move on with my life. Now my butterfly is coming home and, well."
Marcy smiled, took his elbow, and walked toward the lobby desk. "Here's the couple I was telling you about," Sue Fishman said when Jack and Marcy walked into Kiki's.
Jack was handed two glasses of champagne. A four-piece band was covering popular songs, and Marcy soon had Jack back on the dance floor. After a couple of numbers, she whispered,
"Do you really want to stay here?"
Jack smiled and shook his head. He reached into his pocket and took out his room key.
"Perfect. Let's go."
Chapter 45. It was morning, and Liam sat on the apartment couch, fiddling with the TV remote.
"What are you searching for?"
Kayla asked from behind as she entered the room.
"Something I can understand," he said without looking up.
"The Bachelorette.
Do I look like someone who watches?" As he turned, he caught a look at Kayla.
"Oh." Unlike her previous stylish outfits, she now wore a flowing paneled skirt long enough to cover the top of her shoes, a knit top with sleeves to her wrists, and a plum-colored hijab, which flattered the oval of her face. Liam stared for a moment.
Where are you going that you need to pretend to be a Muslim woman? She smiled. Who says I'm not? Liam shook his head. Every day I'm with you, I know you less. We're going into H1, the Palestinian sector. I'd like to go to the Breadstone Bakery, and I don't want to attract attention to myself. Liam smiled and shook his head. I got news for you. You will turn heads wherever you go in whatever you wear. Why, thank you, Liam. That was sweet. Just stating the obvious. You're a beautiful woman. He looked down at his cotton shirt, worn over a black t-shirt, shirt tails outside his jeans. How am I supposed to dress? Just the way you are. Jeans are fine. Liam squinted in the bright sun as they left the building and started their walk toward Hebron. The desert wind blew an occasionally puffy cloud across the sky. The Judean hills, with their scruff and untamed grasses, spread to the horizon on a palette of ikru, goldenrod, and brown. Rocky limestone outcroppings and ancient olive trees spotted the hills, all of which seemed to say, "We are inhospitable." Yet Liam and Kayla strolled toward Hebron, one of the oldest and most densely populated cities in the world. As they reached the outer edge of Kiryat Arba, Kayla pointed to the hills in front of them, blanketed with thousands of square, white stone edifices, tightly packed together.
Hebron, pronounced Hebron in Hebrew and called Al-Khalil in Arabic. It's a city of nearly 200,000 people, largest in the West Bank. King David founded the Kingdom of Israel and ruled here for 7 of his 41 years. For 3,700 years, Hebron's been important to Jews. In 1967, at the end of the bloody battle for the Temple Mount, Menachem Begin stood at the Western Wall and prayed. He said, "And we shall yet come to Hebron, Kiryat Arba, and there we shall prostrate ourselves at the graves of the patriarchs of our people." Hebron's that important to Jews, Liam. Ben-Gurion considered Israel's right to Hebron to be indefeasible. A stone path through a small park took them down a hill and onto a narrow paved street. The blacktop, broken and cracked in many places, wound its way along the Hebron H1-H2 border. A soldier in an olive IDF uniform, his Tavor TAR-21 strapped across his back, leaned against the door of a shuttered building and nodded as they crossed the street from Kiryat Arba.
"We are now in H2 Hebron," Kayla said. "In 1997, Yasser Arafat and Benjamin Netanyahu agreed to split the city into two sectors. They called it the Hebron Protocol. Israelis may not enter Palestinian Hebron without permission. To all intents and purposes, the IDF has withdrawn its soldiers from H1.
Another IDF soldier passed them on the street, nodded, and said hello to Kayla in Hebrew. Liam looked at her.
"Time to fess up. You know these people. You were stationed here, weren't you? You're not just some historical resource analyst in the State Department."
"Don't jump to conclusions. I do work for the State Department."
"But not just for the State Department?"
She shrugged.
"And before?"
"I thought we were going to leave those doors closed."
"If you have some clandestine agenda planned here in Hebron, we need to open those doors. I have a right to know. Exactly what is your assignment? It's certainly not to be my chauffeur and schoolmarm."
"Schoolmarm?"
"I think it was. You asked to be educated, to know your adversaries, as I recall. I've done a pretty damn good job in that regard. As to the second part, I got you here safe and sound with no complaints about my driving. Don't patronize me, Kayla. I've served my time in this business, and I have a right to know who I'm partnering with."
Kayla nodded.
"Yes, you do.
On the books, I'm a diplomatic attaché, assigned as a resource to assist you in your investigation." "And off the books?"
"As Harry told you, I'm looking at Al-Zahani. It's not an official operation yet, so maybe I'm a tiny bit rogue in what we're doing. But there's no question his group is planning something and we need to figure it out. Our first stop today will be at Avraham Avenue. There's someone I'd like you to meet."
As they walked past a newly constructed apartment building, Kayla asked Liam,
"Why did you leave the service?"
He shrugged.
"My assignment in Ireland was over. I had no interest in an office or administrative job, and frankly, I was tired of working for the government.
Unless we accept a senior staff post on some foreign desk, people like you and me, we have no future in this business. Working for myself seemed like a good idea.
And has it been?
Pretty much. Why do you want to start at the bakery?
You'll know in a minute.
They opened the door to a domed building housing a tiny synagogue and entered the sanctuary through one of three stone archways. Walnut railings framed a bima in the center of the room. An open book sat on a pulpit. A carved wooden ark, the Aron Kodesh, stood along the wall facing the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. A decorative Ner Tamid, the eternal light, hung above the ark. A large chandelier lit the center of the dome.
Enchanting, Liam said, looking around the sanctuary.
And cozy. Is this where we're meeting your contact? She nodded.
This is the Avraham Avenue Synagogue. The original was built in 1540. In the years after the 1948 war, during the time that Jordan occupied the city, the Jewish section was torn apart and demolished. They converted this area into a trash dump and a public toilet. Right where we're standing, they placed a goat and donkey pen. As soon as Israel liberated the area in 1967, the synagogue restoration began.
A man who had been sitting quietly on a chair in the dark of a corner rose to greet them.
Quite right. Kayla knows her history. Aaron, this is Liam Taggett, the investigator. Liam, meet Aaron Weinberg, a treasure in this community. We are grateful for your service, Aaron said as he clasped Liam's hand.
To Kayla, he said,
we have not seen Fakir at the bakery yet today, so it may be a good day to try for the placement.
She nodded.
And the evil doctor? Nothing unusual. No change in his routine. Have we learned anything further about the group?
He shook his head.
That is why we hope you can successfully place the device.
He handed a small plastic square to Kayla.
I think we'll head to the market now, Kayla said. I'll walk part way with you,
Aaron said. Then he asked Liam,
have you been to Israel before?
No, this is my first time. Walking from the synagogue, Liam noticed a colorful mosaic on the side of the stone wall. He stopped to examine it, furrowed his forehead, and looked at Aaron. That's a disturbing piece of artwork. Aaron nodded.
Tell me why you think so.
Well, it's an orange baby buggy, but it has giant red flames of fire coming out of where the baby would sleep. And then there's a line of Hebrew words that I don't understand.
It's a memorial, Liam, to a 10-month-old girl, Shal Chevet Pas, who was murdered right here where you stand. Just a baby.
He pointed at the horizon.
Do you see the security tower on the crown of that Hebron hill? It used to be the side of a tall building in the Palestinian neighborhood of Abu Snene. From there, a sniper shot the little baby through the head. Her father, who was pushing the buggy, was hit by two bullets himself. The shooter's building was subsequently torn down by the IDF.
Aaron brushed away a leaf from the memorial.
As if that weren't disturbing enough, when they caught the sniper, he confessed that he was aiming at the baby.
Thank God they caught him.
Well, the Palestinians were the first to arrest him, but then they let him go. It took Israeli security to find him and take him into custody.
Kayla reached down, lifted a handful of arid, rust-colored sand and held it out for Liam to see.
This dry dirt, these pebbles, these astringent stones of Hebron from which you would think nothing can grow? Well, you'd be wrong. Hebron spawned some of the world's worst terrorists. They erupt from the soils here, Liam. So many of them, full of rage and hate. They sprout out of the ground like weeds and find nourishment in the stones here. They don't want peace in this land, and they will never accept it. That sniping occurred during the Al-Aqsa Infitata.
She dropped the stones, brushed her hands together.
There are schools throughout the Palestinian territories that are named in honor of suicide bombers,
Aaron added.
Even kindergartens, in tribute to terrorists.
Liam shook his head.
And they call this the Holy Land? The baby's father. His name was Yitzhak Pas.
He was a young man, a student here, said Aaron. You can't imagine his despair. The whole country wept with them. But then Yitzhak joined the group that planned an act of retribution. Violence begets violence, Liam. And regrettably, it hasn't been all one-sided.
That's true, Kayla said. Except on this side of the fence, people do not gather in the streets to cheer violence and shoot guns into the air. Here we put them in jail. Yitzhak Pass was arrested in possession of explosives and was sentenced to 2 years for plotting.
Israel jailed the baby's father?
Kayla nodded. Terrorism is terrorism. No exceptions. Let's move on. A quarter mile farther, and a huge stone fortress came into view. An ancient structure whose 30-foot walls were built of large, rectangular blocks of oatmeal-colored limestone. A guardhouse with armed police sat at the top of wide steps that swooped upward from a small plaza below. Liam looked at Kayla and tilted his head in the direction of the structure.
The Cave of the Patriarchs, she said. Marat HaMachpelah. The land that Abraham bought from Ephron to bury his wife. Genesis tells the story in exquisite detail. This place has been a sacred site for thousands of years, a place of religious pilgrimage, long before there was any significance to Jerusalem.
Kayla stopped and stared. Her throat caught and she turned her head to dab her eyes.
Would you mind? She said to Liam and Aaron. May I have a moment, please?
She walked a short distance to where the grass met the walkway, bowed her head, and appeared to be lost in prayer.
What is this all about?
Liam asked Aaron.
She's saying Kaddish, Aaron said quietly. Prayers spoken by mourners. Really, a series of prayers, praising and sanctifying the names of God and praying for peace.
For whom does she say Kaddish?
It's not for me to say. She'll tell you in her time if she wants you to know.
When she returned, her eyes were red and her lips were quivering. It was clear to Liam that she had confronted a difficult memory. Are you all right? She tried to speak, but just shook her head. He put his arm around her shoulders. She put her head on his chest and wept. As they walked slowly from the site, Aaron picked up the conversation.
3,700 years ago, so the story goes, Abraham, the wandering shepherd, was seated outside his tent, right in this very area. Three strangers approached. Abraham offered them shelter and a meal, but the calf he selected for dinner broke loose and ran into one of the caves. Abraham went searching. There was a fire in the mouth of a cave, placed there by angels so that no man could enter. But when Abraham approached, the fire died and Abraham went in. There he smelled a sweet and lovely fragrance. As he walked further into the cave, he came upon Adam and Eve in their eternal rest. Beyond them lay the entrance to the Garden of Eden, from whence the lovely fragrance emanated. But Abraham could not enter because man had been expelled from paradise. When Abraham returned to his tent, the strangers were gone. It is that cave, that very cave, Machpelah, which Abraham purchased for the burial of his beloved wife, Sarah. The structure you see was built by King Herod 2,000 years ago to surround and protect Machpelah, and it has remained generally intact throughout the ages. Saladin, the first sultan of Egypt and Syria, who conquered this land in the 12th century, added the turrets. A mosque was constructed inside. Access to the caves themselves has been closed for 500 years. There are now cenotaphs, empty tombs for the patriarchs and matriarchs, decorated and sitting in small chapels, which can be visited within the structure.
So Abraham actually purchased this land? Liam said. He got a deed? Kayla nodded.
I see where you're going. My teachings have not fallen on deaf ears.
Yes, as it is written, he purchased the land, the fields, the caves, and all the trees within its borders to bury his wife, and so that he might be buried there as well. It was all done in a well-documented real estate transaction for 400 shekels, a fair market price for the property, in the presence of all the Hittites.
And so the father of the Jews becomes the first Jewish landowner in Hebron.
In all of Israel, as far as we know, Aaron said. He insisted on the deed. Efron wanted to make a gift of the property, but Abraham was shrewd. He knew he could only pass it on to his heirs if it was purchased and deeded. You could certainly say that the concept of a Jewish homeland began with that real estate purchase. But remember, Muslims consider Abraham to be a prophet and an ancestor of Muhammad.
Kayla put her hand gently on Liam's arm.
Thank you for your understanding back at the steps.
They walked on a little farther until they reached the Israeli checkpoint to the H-1 border.
This is as far as I can go, Aaron said.
Liam shook his hand and bid him goodbye. Once Liam and Kayla had cleared the checkpoint and began their walk into the center of Hebron, Liam said,
You were at that wedding, weren't you? At the cave of Machpelah? Where the terrorist shooting occurred.
Kayla shut her eyes.
Yes, I was.
And back at the checkpoint, one of the IDF guards knew you, didn't he?
Not IDF. Magov, Israeli border police. They provide the security here.
An old friend? Kayla nodded, and they walked on. The market area of central Hebron, Bab al-Zawiya, was bustling with daytime shoppers. Just off the square, a fluttering canvas awning over a shop proclaimed in Arabic script, it was the Breadstone Bakery. Liam stopped Kayla before they could enter the bakery.
Tell me why we're here. It's not because we might pick up a little gossip. It's not because the group met here in the past, and it's certainly not to buy a donut. Why are we really here?
Kayla moved close to Liam and opened her hand to reveal the small, black plastic listening device that Aaron had handed to her.
I'm going to plant this in a back room. Let's enter separately.
Breadstone's interior walls were lined with glass cases displaying the morning's products. The customers, mainly women, were snatching up hot rolls, sweets, and pitas. Liam pretended to be interested in the pastries, while Kayla conversed with a young man behind a display case. She asked for a sample wheat pita, which she held to her nose. She took a small bite out of the edge, tilted her head back and forth in a so-so gesture, and said a few words to the clerk, who snapped a few words back to her. She turned and ambled back to where Liam was standing, stopping to look into the bakery racks.
I told him the pita was tasty, but a bit dry and cold, so I couldn't tell how old it was. She said quietly, I ordered 12 hot pitas right out of the oven, and I didn't want him taking the cold pitas and putting them in the microwave. You saw him? He said he didn't sell old pitas, that I should take them out of the oven myself. And I said, Fine. The oven is in the back room, which is what I had hoped for.
She looked around at the busy bakery.
I need a distraction. When I go into the back, see if you can grab the attention of the shopkeepers and keep them busy. I just need a couple minutes.
Kayla followed the clerk into the back. Liam elbowed his way up to the case and pointed at a pastry.
Excuse me. Excuse me, he said loudly. I'd like a sweet roll. Understand? Sweet? Roll? Do you have to take a number here? I didn't see any numbers. Where is your number machine?
A clerk came over and spread his hands in a questioning gesture.
I want something sweet and gooey. That one. No, not that one. That one. Yep. Nope, more to the left. That one. Nope, the other one.
The sales clerk uttered a phrase under his breath, shook his head, rolled his eyes, and called for the other clerk to come from the back room to help him.
I speak English, said the second clerk. What do you want?
I want a gooey cinnamon sweet roll and a cup of coffee.
No cinnamon, no coffee. The clerk reached into the case. Here, take this, you like it.
Liam furrowed his forehead.
What's in it?
Almond, it's good. Here, take it.
Liam fumbled with some money in his pocket.
No charge. Goodbye.
Liam saw Kayla come out of the back room with a paper bag and leave through the front door. He took a bite of his sweet roll.
Mmm!
He held it up for all to see.
Man, this is pretty good. Not too bad at all.
He nodded to the woman in the store, holding out the sweet roll.
You should all try this. It's almond. Very tasty.
The clerk closed his eyes.
Okay, go now, go.
Have a nice day, Liam said loudly to the clerk and the women in the store, bowing, smiling, and backing out the door to meet Kayla on the sidewalk.
Nice work, Liam. The clerk took me into the back where the baking ovens were. The pita oven is a noisy, belted thing. I waited by the oven, taking my pitas as they dropped onto the tray. The clerk stood right beside me until you started your commotion. As you know, he rushed into the store to quiet you down. Behind the ovens, there's a large office. It's also a sitting room with chairs and a couch. I managed to attach the bug to the underside of the couch. I believe that's where the group held its meetings.
Why is that important? You told me they met her in the past, but they don't meet her anymore.
I have reason to believe they might meet her again. Now, let's have a look at Al Zahani's residence.
What about Fakir the baker? I want to talk to him, see if he'll let on whether there's a deal in place.
He's not coming in today. His son told me he only comes in a couple times a week. He'll be back on Thursday. We can come back then. Right now, I'd like you to see Al Zahani's layout from street level, and then we'll head back to Jerusalem.
Maybe it's time for you to pay another visit to Abu Hamad.
They exited the taxi 3 blocks from Al Zahani's home and approached the walled residence from the west, walking slowly on the opposite side of the street.
Compound is huge, Liam said.
He must have 3 acres.
4.2 to be exact.
Kayla pointed. The black iron gate in the front is controlled mechanically. On satellite, we've seen what appears to be multiple security guards. Sometimes they patrol the perimeter.
Why the hell does a doctor need multiple security guards?
I doubt it has anything to do with Sophie. It's all about what's going on behind those walls. The devil's workshop of the Sons of Canaan.
Liam shaded his eyes and stared at the property.
What's on the other side of those walls? How many structures?
3. A large home, easily 4,000 square feet.
A small building, probably a utility garage. And a rectangular one-story structure, maybe 3,000 square feet.
That's where the mysteries lie. And we don't have a clue what's going on inside.
Just then, a large man in a tan sport coat, holding the hand of a little girl, turned the corner and headed for the front gate. In his free hand, he carried a small pink backpack.
Sophie skipped along, trying to keep up with his stride.
Their conversation was animated. Sophie laughed. Suddenly, 3 guards materialized in front of the gate.
That's Sophie.
Liam immediately grabbed Kayla by the shoulders, turned her to the side, and wrapped his arms around her.
I don't want the guards to see our faces. Let them think we're lovers standing on the corner.
From the corner of his eye, appearing to be locked in a passionate embrace, Liam watched the guards take their stations and open the mechanized gate for Bashir and Sophie. When the two had entered, the guards closed the gate and resumed their patrol of the perimeter. One guard lit a cigarette, pointed at the kissing couple across the street, and chuckled and sniggered to his companions. When they were out of sight, Liam released Kayla, who opened her eyes widely, took a deep breath, and smiled. Her face was flushed. She licked her lips.
It's quite a move you've got there, Irish. You got my heart beating. I'm impressed.
He took Kayla by the elbow and walked away from the property.
They must be coming home from school.
He checked his watch. 3:15.
We should find that school. It might be a good location if we want to grab her.
Arm in arm, they walked a few blocks past Al Zahani's walls, tracing Bashir's route, and came upon a mosque with an extended school building. A fenced-in area held a little playground. Liam took a couple of pictures with his phone. On the return to Kiryat Arba, they once again walked past the Avraham Avenue Synagogue. Kayla pointed. In August 1929, this was one of the locations of the Hebron Massacre.
You didn't tell me about the Hebron Massacre.
I told you, when we were back in Chicago, that 1929 was a violent year. Mufti Amin al-Husseini and Ibrahim were waging a heated campaign against Jewish immigration and those who had already settled here. They called them Zionist invaders. They demanded that they all leave Palestine. In the heat of the summer, tensions heightened. Jews were randomly attacked, leaving their schools. Then in August 1929, there was an incident. 3 Jewish children and 3 Arabs were killed in Jerusalem.
That was a starter's pistol shot for Amin and Ibrahim. They riled up their followers with wild street demonstrations. An Arab messenger raced to Hebron on his motorcycle and announced, "I bring news from the Mufti. The blood of thousands of Muslims is being shed like water in Jerusalem." A crazed mob then took to the streets with knives, clubs, and axes. They stoned Jewish houses, ransacked the hospital, raped, murdered, mutilated, tortured. Kayla shook her head. Where were the police? Because Hebron was such a peaceful town, there weren't many British police stationed here. Basically, the Jews and Arabs in Hebron got along pretty well before the riot. Anyway, here in this synagogue, many came to hide from the marauders. But eventually the doors were breached and the people were slaughtered. Hebron's chief rabbi Slonim sheltered several of the Ashkenazi yeshiva students in his home, but they were soon surrounded. Many of the Arab rioters knew and respected Rabbi Slonim. They banged on his door and offered him a choice. Hand over the Ashkenazi students and we'll let you, your family, and the Sephardic Jews live. I'm sorry, the rabbi said. That I cannot do. Thereupon, Rabbi Slonim, his entire family, and all the Jews he was sheltering were slaughtered. All in all, 67 Jews were murdered. Finally, British reinforcements came to Hebron and took the 484 survivors north to Jerusalem. Never quit in this region, does it? It will quit, Liam. You have to believe it. When we rid this land of extremists like the Al-Zahonis, it will quit. And the proof was here in Hebron. Before the Hebron massacre, it was a peaceful town of Arabs and Jews living side by side. It can happen. The proof was here. But not anymore. Not yet.